begun now dealing with the Constitution of the United States of America. What has that got to do with religion? Well, directly nothing. It has nothing to do with the Bible directly. However, indirectly, it has a great deal to do with the Word of God. Psalms 9:17 said, "The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all nations that forget God." There is a national indictment in this Bible for any nation that would turn its back upon God, that would fail to remember who He is and what position He holds. God said that He'll deal with that nation accordingly. And of course, the verse we've used as our key verse is Psalm 33, verse 12. I hope you have memorized it. If not, then perhaps you need to do so. "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom He hath chosen for His inheritance." There is a blessing involved when God is the God of a nation. And we talked a little bit about that last week. It does not mean that everybody in that nation has the same particular viewpoint. It does not mean that everybody sees God exactly doctrinally the same way. There is a lot of room for doctrinal diversity. As a matter of fact, America is a place where even an atheist can find a haven. And as a Christian, I believe that. I believe, and I'm probably as, I hate to use the term because it's been made into a bad term, but I'm a radical, I guess. When I disagree with somebody and their religious viewpoints, I'm going to tell you about it. When I disagree with a religion and what that religion teaches, I'm going to tell you from the pulpit what I believe and why I believe they're wrong and I'm right. And I believe in defending what we believe. This is a sad day when people will sweep their beliefs under the carpet in order to get along. You're living really in the most volatile society now because of that. People have swept all their differences under the carpet and pretended like they didn't exist. And because of that, you just at any moment wouldn't surprise us at all. I don't think this morning to find out, you know, it's been a great explosion in this city and this group has gone to battle against this group. Why is that? Because we've been pretending for the last 40 years, excuse me, that nothing is wrong. That we disagree and let's forget about that. No, let's figure out why we disagree and let's come to, even if we can't figure one is right and one is wrong, let's at least come to a compromise. We've refused to face the issue. We've refused to even look at the issue. We've pretended like the issue doesn't exist, and we've created a volatile situation. Now, because of that, we need to go back and understand where our country came from. And because of the lack of efficiency in the public sector as far as education is concerned, and the lack of emphasis placed anymore on education, it's necessary somebody else does it. And while it may seem like an unusual thing for a church to do it, I would remind you, if you go back to pre-Revolutionary War, the only people teaching history were churches. The only people dealing with governmental issues were preachers prior to the Revolutionary War. And that's one of the reasons I think you got what you got when you got a constitution put together. And so we began last week looking at the idea that beyond 1776 and the end of the war in 1783, when the Treaty of Paris was signed, that basically ended hostilities between the United States and Great Britain, gave the colonies their independence, and they were acknowledged, really nobody knew as what, because of the fact that they didn't have a government. They had no system of unity among themselves. They had fought together, and really it wasn't important during the Revolutionary War that they be assembled on a federal level because they were united in purpose. They were united in goal. They all wanted the same thing. They all wanted to be free from English dominion. And so it was easy for them to line side by side and go to battle and fight a battle. But now the battle's over and they have no common purpose anymore. They don't have much in common at this point. They go back to their different colonies, now states. Each of them have different major imports and exports. Each of them have different cities and ideas. And remember, they were founded from colonies, and those colonies existed on different charters. And so now what becomes apparent after the war is over are the differences that exist between these colonies. They are not the same. And how then can they come together and form a federal government? How then can they come together and form a country? Not only that, but the other nations really didn't take what had happened any too seriously. Not even England did. A number of the forts in America that had been built by English soldiers have not been vacated. There are still English soldiers fortified in these new independent colonies. And so there's a great fear. England, it is believed, was just waiting for the new formed alliance between these states to collapse, and at that point they would move back in again. And so these American citizens, these patriots, are wondering what in the world is going on. The first form or the first system of government that governed our country was what's called the Articles of Confederation. And they were agreed upon actually in the early days of the Revolutionary War just to provide some semblance of cooperation among the colonies. I said before, when all the different states sent their militias to go to battle, who gives the orders? I mean, is it the general of the militia of Virginia, or is it the general from the Maryland militia? Who gives the orders? Who's in command? And so the states got together, formed the Articles of Confederation to try and iron some of those problems out. So America first existed as a confederacy. And we talked about that last week. Under a confederacy, the states have the supreme power. They form a federal government, but the federal government really is there to do the bidding of the states. And we hear a lot about states' rights, and we'll hear a great deal more about it when we get to the Civil War and those days when really states' rights were once and forever put under the carpet and done away with. But states' rights meant that, hey, Virginia had a right to decide its own sovereignty and its own destiny, and they sent delegates to a central committee there called the Congress, or whatever they chose to call it, and they were there to do the bidding of the states, completely opposite of what exists today. Now, as these people got together, the Articles of Confederation we talked about last week, they had some strong points. They also had a number of weak points. And some of the weak points that we mentioned was the fact that this body that was created by the Articles of Confederation did not have the right to regulate foreign commerce. It could not regulate imports and exports. And what immediately happened, again, while England left their troops here in a great number of cases, England began to swamp America's markets with mercantile goods sold at much less than Americans could produce them. There was an economic war that was being waged even after the Revolutionary War. And the attempt was to, Brother Mel's here, he's making barrels, I guess is a good thing that people made back then. And Brother Mel, in order to make those barrels, he has to, certainly he can go get wood from the American resources, but he's going to need nails, and he's going to need iron, and he's going to need tools from various sources. And remember, before the Revolutionary War, Americans couldn't even manufacture their own iron. England had so imposed its governing restrictions on America that all crude ore had to be shipped to England and refined there and then sold back to the colonists. So the colonists didn't even have a way of manufacturing their own iron goods. That England had done that. And now he's having to buy from various countries these materials necessary to make the goods. All they have to do is raise the prices on what they're selling him, and before long they're able to import and sell barrels at half or a third what he has to charge for them. He has no ability to make a living then. And England is just waiting, as well as France. There are a number of nations that could be accused of what went on following the Revolutionary War, of really vultures circling, waiting for the final collapse so they could swoop in and take what they felt was theirs by right. And another weakness in the Articles of Confederation was the fact that the centralized government did not have the power to regulate interstate commerce. All right, there's one thing to have foreign commerce, there's another thing to have interstate commerce. And what began to arise were little disputes. And if Maryland got on the outs with Virginia, then you'd find Virginia was paying three times what for particular goods, what somebody else would only pay, you know, a few cents for. Virginia would have to pay triple that. Why? Because they were on the outs. They didn't like each other. And there was nothing there to regulate that. Say, hey, you've got to be fair. You've got to sell the same price to everybody. And a lot of problems arose. Finally, one of the great problems of the Articles of Confederation was it gave the centralized government no power to tax. And I know we hate that word, and somebody said, well, I just don't like paying taxes. I've never met anybody that really did. I have never run into anybody and said, oh, glory to God, it's April the 15th and we get to go pay our taxes. And I don't enjoy it, but we pay them. We pay them as a necessary evil, I suppose. And Christ recognized that when Peter came and said, hey, it's tax time. And he said, well, go fishing. Now, a lot of people like to do that when it comes tax time, but he had a purpose in mind, and that was to provide for the tribute that Caesar had demanded. And as a government, I guess that's one of the rights that is there, is the right to tax. Now, in a good government, the right to tax is the right merely to provide existence for that centralized government. We mentioned the fact last week you needed ambassadors to other countries. You needed representatives here and there. You needed buildings in which to meet. Somebody has to pay for those things. Somebody has to pay the lights and the heat. Somebody has to take care of those things, and that should come from the people that that government represents. Now, certainly with the day and age in which we live, the complaint is that the government has really grown so large that it's destroying the rest of the country, and I'm not going to disagree with that. But the idea of taxation is not a bad idea. It has to be done. I mean, you figure this morning we talk about the church, and the church doesn't impose a tax, but God, in essence, has demanded tribute from his people. That tribute's called what? It's called a tithe. God has regulated that we're to tithe. You say, why is that? Somebody's got to pay the light bills and the heat bills, the building payments. Somebody's got to take care of those things. And so God imposed the tithe on his people to take care of those things that exist with regard to the ministry. So while the church doesn't maintain the power to tax, although it has in the past in some foreign countries, the church does not exercise the right to tax. But certainly I can get up here with the Bible and say, God said this is what is to be done. And can we deny a government the right to exist? If it is going to exist for the people, then it needs the right to tax. And of course, in this case, it was to tax the states. It wasn't that the right to tax didn't exist, because the states maintained the right to tax, and they were taxing their people. As a matter of fact, we'll look here in a moment when it comes to Shay's rebellion. They were taxing their people to such an extent that the people couldn't even make a living, kind of like where we're at right now. But it wasn't the federal government doing it, it was the state governments that were doing it at that point. So the federal government had no right to tax, and that's a weakness in the Articles of Confederation. Now, obviously, as time went on and squabbles began to arise, the imperfections of the Articles of Confederation became ever more obvious. And as they became ever more obvious, there was recognized the need that something had to be done to improve upon the Articles of Confederation. And several things occurred which precipitated what we would call our Constitutional Convention. First of all was Shay's Rebellion. How many of you never heard of Shay's Rebellion before last week? Shay's Rebellion was a rebellion, a small rebellion that took place in the state of Massachusetts. And again, the states had the right to tax. And the states began to tax, and then they began to tax, and then they began to tax. And before long, people are running out of money to pay their taxes. Land was basically very cheap. We mentioned the fact you could buy land for, no less than a dollar an acre. So it was not expensive. What happened was the taxing became to such a point that people couldn't pay it. And what took place then was the obvious. People had mortgages on their homes and their farms and their whatever they owned, and foreclosure proceedings began. And when the foreclosure proceedings began, people began to lose their livelihood. Shay was one of those people who was disgruntled with the situation. And Shay organized a group of individuals, a militia, and they proceeded to close down foreclosure courts all over the state of Massachusetts. When the courts would convene and they were there for the purpose of deciding whether someone was going to lose their home or farm or whatever, they got together and closed down the court. Today we have Farm Aid and this kind of other thing, I guess maybe along the same line, but Shay went about it a little differently, and that was he just closed the court down, ran the judge out of town, and that was that. That didn't sit very well with the state of Massachusetts, because it infringed on their right to collect taxes. And so they began to seek this fellow to prosecute him. And Shay and his group broke into an armory and stole some materials and weapons of war. And there was a battle that took place, and that was the end of that. But obviously, the other states sitting back looking at that realized we're going to have the same thing here. If something is not done, we're going to have some problems like this in our own state. And so one of the things that called for perhaps a reevaluation of the Articles of Confederation, perhaps something else, as we'll see in a minute, was Shays' Rebellion. Another thing was the fact that several states had gotten together in their disagreements and had come to a conclusion, had come to an agreement. Sometimes we think it's worthless to talk. Amen? Sometimes we think it's worthless to talk, it's not going to do any good, nothing's ever going to come out of this, so why sit down and talk? But you'd be amazed at the value sometimes of just sitting down and talking to somebody. I know some people that have had some dealings with the IRS, and we was talking the other day, you know, you can go in with an attitude that's going to get you in trouble. You really can. You know, you can come into my office with an attitude that'll get you in trouble. Somebody said, well, you know, that IRS agent went in there and, boy, it was trouble from the very get-go. Yeah, but you come into my office and it'd be trouble from the very get-go, too. A lot of it has to do with attitude. And I saw somebody the other day that said, I went in and I was polite and I acknowledged what they were saying and I explained to them what had happened and I told them, this is why I want to get this over with. And said they're just as polite as they could be. A lot of it's attitude. You know, it never hurts to sit down and talk. It never hurts to sit down and I see police officers all the time. They're given, you know, they read the Riot Act, and it's not really their job. You know, we expect police officers to come to our door and interpret the law, and that's not their job. Sometimes when a police officer shows up on your doorstep and you say, well, now, wait a minute, do you think that's fair? He's not there to determine whether that's fair or not. That's the judge's job. We get confused. The police officer's job is, did you do it? Yes, I did. You're going to jail. I don't think it's fair. Doesn't matter whether you think it's fair or not. And it's his not his job to determine whether it's fair or not. It's his job to do his job, which is take you to jail. And sometimes we get confused. And so you get real hostile with a police officer. And guess what happens? He gets real hostile back. And it need not be that way. I've seen people argue with fellows about speed limit signs, you know. Well, that's stupid, you know. They shouldn't have a speed limit sign like that out here. That's absurd. Everybody else was going fast. It doesn't matter. He's got you, and he's going to give you a ticket. You say, why? That's what he's paid to do. He's not there to go say, well, boy, you know, you're right. I'm just going to take this magic marker and change this to 55 miles an hour because you're right. It should be much faster. That's not his job. His job is to take care of business. And what happened is states began to drift apart from one another because they felt there was no need to talk. We're separate sovereign entities. But several states began to get together because they had some problems that had to be hammered out. Virginia and Maryland had a disagreement over commercial navigation in the Potomac River. And, you mean, who declares the right-of-way? Who declares the speed limit? Both states border on that river. And, you know, you just can't have ships running into each other with 300 or 400 people on board and all kind of goods. Something had to be done. And those states got together, held a conference, sat down at a table in just a little portion of time. They hammered out a compromise that determined the navigational rights of the Potomac River. You say, well, what's that got to do with the Constitution? Nothing other than the fact that it began to illustrate when these states got together, they began to get things done. You see, those ideas are contagious. When they got together and they produced things that got the job done, people began to look at that and said, let's get all the states together then. And let's hammer out our differences and let's arrive at a compromise that can govern our country. Another thing was Washington had called delegates to Mount Vernon. And he had gathered them together there for what was called the Annapolis Convention. And they began to talk about some of the things that were wrong with the Articles of Confederation. So they called for delegates to come to Philadelphia. And they said, it's time for us to settle down and to figure this thing out. Well, the first time they all showed up, only five states came. And you know, under the Articles of Confederation, five states didn't even have the right to decide anything. So it was really a wasted trip. So they all went away, but they had called for everybody to come back the next year, and they made an earnest plea that our nation is in jeopardy if something is not done. So the following year, they gathered together. I've got all my good notes here this morning. It is time to turn a page. All right. They gathered together in Philadelphia, and there were 55 individual delegates that appeared from the 13 colonies, with the exception of Rhode Island. Rhode Island did not send any delegates, and they came together to consider the Articles of Confederation and what could be done to strengthen the governmental system that we had. Now again, I don't want to bore you, but I wish sometimes we could put ourselves into the position that these people had to face. They didn't know what kind of government to establish. I mean, you know, if we were going to found our own country today and set out, we got us a piece of land, we'd sit down and we'd say, now what kind of government do we want? We could look at really dozens of governmental systems. We could say, well, there's a monarchy in this country, and there's a parliamentary government in this country. There's a socialist government in this country. There is a dictatorship in this country. There is democracy here. And we could sit down and analyze all the various types of government, which is well and good. But I want you to remember, this predates both socialism and democracy. These people can't sit down and say, I know, let's elect our president, elect... They didn't even know what a House of Representatives were. There wasn't any Senate. These people, all they had to draw on was the monarchical systems of Europe or the dictatorships, and they'd had their stomach of both of those. The only thing that they knew that they agreed on was the fact they didn't want a monarchy and they didn't want a dictatorship in this country. Beyond that, they had nothing to compare. They had nothing to look at and analyze. They had nothing to try and pattern our government after. It was really a shot in the dark. And so as they came together, the 55 delegates came. I'll give you a list of some of the people who were there. Of course, Benjamin Franklin was there, and Benjamin Franklin is counted as a great statesman, and he was. He did not have a lot to do with the Constitution. Ben Franklin was 81 years of age when the Constitutional Convention convened. Now, that's elderly even in our day and time. But back then, when the average lifespan was around 42 years of age, Ben Franklin was extremely old. And he conveyed messages to the Constitutional Convention by means that he'd write his speeches, but another had to deliver them. He was not in good enough health to even stand and address the Constitutional Convention. But he was there in attendance at the urging of others, as well as George Washington. Washington had retired from his military career and really had gone back to private life. Washington owned a great plantation. He was a businessman. And he had gone back to his private life, his plantation, and he had no intentions of attending the Constitutional Convention when word was first announced. It was at the urging of the people in his state that he go, because he represented something to America that America needed, and that was strength and stability. Washington had arthritis, crippling arthritis and rheumatism, and sometimes really could barely move. And Washington had no desire to make the long trip to Philadelphia. But at the urging of others, he did so. And both he and Franklin were really there as figureheads. And while Washington was elected, obviously for the reasons we know, as the presider or the moderator of the Constitutional Convention, that was not his intent. He did not go to be a leader in national affairs. He went because his people urged him, his state's people urged him to go. America needed that representative. James Madison becomes the key figure of the Constitutional Convention. And as we discuss the Constitution, Madison's name will come up over and over and over again. James Madison has the distinction of being known as the father of the Constitution. So if we're going to study the Constitution, it requires that we understand a little bit about Madison, and we'll look at Madison as time goes on. But most Americans have no idea who James Madison is. We'll remember names like Washington, and we'll remember names like Franklin. And again, there's tribute due to those individuals, but they didn't have a lot to do with our Constitution. We remember names like Thomas Jefferson, but Jefferson wasn't even at the convention. It was James Madison. And so as we read what Madison has done, we're going to understand that he basically is the father of the Constitution. As a matter of fact, in 1840, which is several years after the fact, the notes of James Madison that he took at the Constitutional Convention were published for the first time. That's 1840. There's no other written records of what went on at the Constitutional Convention. It was the notes of James Madison that gives us the ability to look back and to determine who said what and what speech was made and what decision was made. And so James Madison really becomes an unsung hero to most of us. We don't know his name, and we wouldn't even know what he did if someone asked us point blank, but he is the father of the Constitution of the United States of America. Jonathan Dayton is an important name at the Constitutional Convention because it gives you an insight into what we have now as opposed to what they had then. Jonathan Dayton is the youngest delegate to the Constitutional Convention of the 55 that met. He is 26 years of age. I just wonder if you could think of a 26-year-old that you would feel competent enough to trust your national destiny to in this day and time. We've changed a whole lot as far as character is concerned. We mentioned John Quincy Adams, which was John Adams' son, and John Quincy Adams was an ambassador to Russia at 14 years of age, representing the United States of America. So youth, you know, we say a lot today about discrimination against our youth and how we mistreat our youth. But I want you to know there was a day and time when our youth had earned a right to represent our nation. They had earned a right to be part of the process, not because they stood back and demanded a right, but because they worked and built a character that gave themselves that right. Paul told Timothy, "Let no man despise thy youth." I believe that. But the idea is not to go around and punch everybody in the face that looks down on you as a youth. The idea in that verse is you live such a life that people have to stand in awe that you're so young and can do what you can do. Because, our young people need to be such that when people look at them, they say, boy, these are not normal teenagers. That's what we try to shoot for here. We don't want normal kids. Why be normal? You know, there's two abnormal people for every normal person in the world. So why be part of the minority? Some of you have to think about that. But normal is the line in the middle, right? It is the midpoint between the two extremes, correct? So there are two extremes then for every midpoint. So there are two abnormal people for every normal person there is in the world. Some are subnormal and others are ultra-normal. And definitely we would like to produce those ultra-normal teenagers. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're trying to teach them. That's what we're trying to pound sometimes into their heads as parents and as pastors and teachers is, hey, don't be like the rest of this crowd. Don't be just a typical teenager where people would look and say, well, you know, that's just being a teenager. Hey, don't be like that. Be like a Jonathan Dayton or a John Quincy Adams who far and beyond their years were able to function and to lead our country. We've given everybody the idea you can't do it till you hit this magical age. And what they find out is when they get to be 40, the magical age still hasn't hit. When does it hit? It doesn't hit. It's time to grow up and do something about it. Jonathan Dayton, 26 years of age, the youngest delegate. Conspicuously absent at this Constitutional Convention are really most of the names that we associate with America and independence. I mentioned the fact that Thomas Jefferson is not present. Thomas Jefferson is in France. He's not around at the Constitutional Convention. Another one who is not there is, I'm trying to think of his name. Signed his name real big. I'm finding my place in my notes here. John Hancock. John Hancock is not there. It was Hancock that signed the Declaration of Independence and said, let me sign it large enough so the king will be sure to know who it is that opposes him. And Hancock was not even elected to go and represent his state. Sam Adams is not there. Sam Adams, somebody was telling me yesterday they just named a beer Sam Adams. What a slam. Sam Adams is recognized as the father of the American Revolution. He was the one that organized the revolution itself. And Sam Adams is not at this convention. John Adams is not at this convention. He is in England. Thomas Paine is not at this meeting. Thomas Paine is in England. And these are names that really surround our thinking about American freedom. None of these men are there. Patrick Henry refused to attend the meeting in Philadelphia. Patrick Henry, I think, probably is the fellow that I can identify with more than any other of our American. He and I seem to click. When I read Patrick Henry, I'm thinking, I would say that. Some of these other guys, I think, I could never say that, or I wouldn't even understand. I don't even understand what they said. But me and Patrick Henry, we get along pretty good. Patrick Henry said, I'm not going because I smell a rat. He suspected from the beginning that it was not to revise the Articles of Confederation, but to come up with some brand new thing. And not that Patrick Henry was opposed to the Constitution that was pounded out, but he was opposed to people meeting together under one guise and doing something entirely different. He said, I smell a rat, and didn't go. The convention began, for all points and purposes, May the 15th, 1787. Now again, this is 4 years after the war has ended, and our country has struggled for 4 years. These men are not coming off of the high of victory. They're not riding in here on their white horses, you know, and the ticker tape parades, and they're going in now to hand. It's not that at all. These men are 4 years beyond the cessation of hostilities. These men are riding in from states where people are losing their homes and bankruptcy is becoming a way of life. These men are riding in to try and figure out what to do because there are large countries waiting in the wings to swoop in and take over this new republic. These men are gathering together really not because they've got some great idea, but because they don't have any ideas, and it's time they found some and made some. The American Constitution, listen, the Declaration of Independence came out of the adrenaline of American resistance, but not so the Constitution. The Constitution is hammered out of difficulty and danger and almost despondency. Something had to be done, and these men knew something had to be done, but they didn't know what. They gathered themselves together, and I say it began May the 14th, but because of travel, it was supposed to begin May the 14th, and they really didn't even have a quorum represented till May the 25th. Again, that's something else we need to consider as we study what goes on in the history of our nation, was the slow travel and communication time. Some of these men, listen, they were just coming from New York or Connecticut, but it took them sometimes 2 and 3 weeks to get there. And while some of these delegates had intended on being there on the beginning of the convention, May the 14th, they didn't arrive till May the 25th. Some of them got there much later than that, but at least a quorum was assembled May the 25th, so the talks could begin. One of the first moves was to find one who would preside over the convention as a moderator. Washington, because of his distinguished character, had no opposition and was placed in control of this meeting that was to be carried out. I said before, James Madison would begin meticulous note-taking that years later would be published as the only source of information we have of what really took place in Independence Hall in Philadelphia. As they met, the first thing that they had to deal with, again, was what kind of government do we want? It was kind of the consensus that as they gathered, they knew the Articles of Confederation wouldn't work. They were aware of that. There was a need, several needs, and several calls for amending the Articles of Confederation, giving the Confederation the right to tax and to regulate commerce. But they knew that that would only be a short-term fix. And what needed to be done was something far more obvious than that to really all the Americans. Something needed to be hammered out that would stand the test of time. And as I said before, there's no pattern. You can't sit down and get out, you know, 50 different governments around the world and pick which one you want. They were taking a shot in the dark. And they began to discuss the various things that must be found in this government, whatever it was. Again, they didn't just pattern after another country. They piecemeal put together the government that we have. And they borrowed from other countries and other governments, and some they just got from God. But they put it all together and gave us what we have today that's lasted 200 years. Now, other nations around the world would mock us, and I've said I've been in Europe several times, and they tend to look at America as, you know, just a spoiled brat, and we've only been around 200 years, and some of those countries have been countries for thousands of years. But they've had hundreds and hundreds of governmental changes in those thousands of years. America stands as really an example of what government by the people can do. We've lasted a long time. And we've got some serious problems today, but I'll be honest with you, I am not so disheartened that I don't think these problems can be taken care of. And I'll tell you where the answer lies to America's problems. As a government, it's all in writing. As a government, every problem we have in America could be answered by an adherence to the Constitution of America. It's all that would be needed. Spiritually, the answer for America, it's all written. It's in the Word of God. If we would adhere to what God said, spiritually, our nation would thrive. If we would adhere to our Constitution, our nation would exist. There is a move afoot even now to rewrite our Constitution because supposedly it is outdated. But it is not outdated that has caused the problems. It is a forsaking of what these individuals hammered out that's produced the problems in our nation. Someone said, well, they couldn't foresee these problems, which may be true. Maybe our forefathers couldn't foresee some of the problems that we have encountered. But are we to assume that the men now have the ability to foresee what their actions are going to do? My opinion is when something has stood the test of time for 200 years, you leave it alone. And you solve those problems one at a time, but you don't jump ship just because you got a leak. You take care of what you got. These men begin to work. The first problem they had was, do we have a confederacy or do we have a federal government? Where do we put the power? Does the power go to the states? Does the power go to the central government? Who gets the final say-so? Can you imagine what a volatile issue that was? Number one, what state wanted to give up its sovereignty? And yet at the same time, these men were wise enough to recognize that something has to be done. We've got to have a central government with some strength. They knew full well that Maryland could not defeat Britain. And they knew that Virginia couldn't defeat France. They knew that not one could stand on its own and withstand an enemy onslaught. They knew that united they would stand. And yet, how do you put together a united form of government when you don't want to sacrifice your sovereignty? Remember, 4 years ago, they had won their sovereignty. Now they're being asked to give it up again. I'm trying to get across to you the thoughts and the heart attitudes that were in these men as they met in Independence Hall in Philadelphia. Sometimes we very, very naively think, well, they just got together, they looked at a piece of paper and said, oh, yeah, that's good to me, I'll vote on that, no problem, I'm going back home now. These men, listen, the first act of Congress in the United States of America was to get on their knees and pray. These individuals knew that what they were trying to do was beyond any abilities that they had. And they called out unto God. Strangely enough, I mentioned last session that we had, that there was at one time a stained glass window in the church in Williamsburg, Virginia, which had been placed there shortly after 1800, which was created from a painting that was done, and it represented our nation's first Congress. And that stained glass window was a picture of all of our forefathers on their knees before God, which was a factual representation of Madison recorded in his notes. They prayed, not just a written prayer. They got on their knees together and prayed that God would help them. That window in Williamsburg, Virginia was taken out for cleaning in 1987 and mysteriously disappeared, along with several hundred Bible-related pieces of material that represented our American history. They're gone. There's nothing religious or biblical left in Williamsburg. It's been taken out. These men begin to pray. How do we do it? Well, first of all, a plan was presented to the Constitutional Convention called the Virginia Plan. It was proposed by Edmund Randolph. The Virginia Plan called for what we now know as a bicameral governmental structure. First of all, it called for an executive and a judiciary branch. That was never a problem. That was one of the things they knew when they went together. We need an executive branch to enforce the law, and we need a judiciary to adjudicate what we put into law. That was never the problem. They knew that had to be there. The problem was, how do we make the laws? The Virginia Plan called for a bicameral representation, which meant there were to be two houses, two bodies that would make laws for America. They would be the centralized government. They would make laws for this country, and they would be placed there totally upon the proportion of the size, the proportion of the states that they represented. In other words, the bigger states would have more representatives than the smaller states. And that way, they felt that America would be represented equally and fairly. Well, the only problem with that is if you're a small state. Remember, it's not just the big states that are being asked to sacrifice their sovereignty. It's the small states as well. And so the small states now have a problem, and that is if we go into this situation, we here in Connecticut may get two representatives, while Virginia may have a dozen. And how can that be fair to the sovereignty of the state of Connecticut? And so another plan was proposed. It was called the New Jersey Plan. The New Jersey Plan was placed on the floor by William Patterson. That's where the term Patterson, New Jersey comes from. It was named after William Patterson. And Patterson called for a unicameral house, one big legislative body that was elected totally upon equal access from each state. In other words, the same number of representatives from each state. And they would gather together and they would create the laws that would govern the nation. Now, you probably don't remember all that stuff, bicameral and unicameral. That was years ago, right? But that was on the floor. Now, the big states all agreed to what? They all liked the Virginia Plan. Why? Because it gave them authority. They were the big ones after all. They had worked the hardest. They had the largest industry. Why shouldn't they have the largest say in the governing of the country? The small states, they all liked the New Jersey Plan. Why? Because it put them on equal footing with the big states. And after all, the big states had the advantages. They had all the industry. They had most of the population. They needed something to bring them up to par with those big states. And the New Jersey Plan did just that. And all at once, we were facing our first compromise. America is a nation of compromise. Or at least it was back until we reached about 1950s. It was a nation of compromise. And a compromise had to be reached. And so all at once, another plan was proposed called the Connecticut Plan, the Connecticut Compromise, as it became known. The Connecticut Compromise called for a bicameral representation. And again, realize each one of these acknowledged the need for an executive branch and a judiciary. How many of you understand what I'm talking about when I talk about that? The executive, of course, is what we would know as our president. The judiciary would be what we know as our Supreme Court. All these plans acknowledged those things had to be there as well. But the Connecticut Compromise called for a bicameral house, two houses to represent, to make laws for the American public. Only the Connecticut Plan called for an upper house and a lower house. The upper house was to be known as the Senate of the United States of America. And the Senate would be the house that had equally the same number of delegates from each state that were represented. And of course, we now know that is how many? Two. Each state in America has two senators to the federal government, the House of the Senate. And so it was established that the upper house would have the same number of representatives from each state. And those representatives, however, were to be elected by the state legislatures. And we'll talk, that idea was changed somewhat later on after our Constitution was founded, but it wasn't a bad idea. Because what it did, it maintained a little power with the states, which we have, in essence, lost over the years, and now some states are demanding it back. Several states have proposed legislation in the last, in the last 6 months, that basically has told Washington to get their nose out. The state of Ohio has done so. It said the Constitution maintains that any right not given to the federal government is reserved to the states, therefore get out of our business. And that probably would not have been necessary had we reserved the right for the state legislatures to nominate the senators that represented us. So that was the original agreement. And the second house, or the lower house, was to be called the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives then was the area where the states or the populations elected the representatives on a proportionate basis. In other words, the larger states have more representatives than the smaller states have. How many of you knew that? Some states have more congressmen than other states. There are larger or smaller congressional districts. And so what happened was a compromise was agreed upon. One represented the big states, one represented the small states. And in order for legislation to be enacted, both houses had to agree upon it. Now, you think about that for a minute, that's brilliant. It literally is brilliant. We don't give enough credit sometimes. These individuals were taking a shot in the dark. And how do you represent, how do you be fair with all of these various problems? And this is not one. The Constitutional Convention was given the nickname of the Great Compromise. Because we'll look at one after another of compromises that had to be reached. But this was brilliant. And it wasn't just a quick fix. It wasn't just like, well, okay, we'll do this then. You wouldn't have something that endured 200 years if it had been done with that frame of mind. These individuals sat down and said, we have a disagreement. I think you're wrong and you think I'm wrong. And let's find out who's right. And they went back and forth and back and forth, and when they began to see, I'll tell you what creates a compromise. Sometimes we think that a compromise is only just a sellout. You know, we fundamentalists have been acknowledged as a people that won't compromise. Well, the word compromise means to sell out to us. And a compromise is not always a sellout. Sometimes, how many of you husbands and wives have ever had to compromise? Okay. Well, does that mean you sold out? Now, I tell you what a valuable compromise is all about. It's seeing the value in a dissenting opinion. It's recognizing that there's some substance to what the fellow I disagree with is saying. And sometimes we just acknowledge bullheadedness for, you know, wisdom. Sometimes the guy's got a point. And what these individuals had to do was sit down and say, listen, I don't care what you say, I don't care what you think, I'm from a small state, and I'm going to be from a small state till the day I die, and I was born in a small state, and I'll die in a small state, and I'm not giving you nothing. Right? I'll tell you what would have happened then, we'd have been English citizens today. These individuals sat down and they said, I don't like what you think. I'm a small state and I don't like the power that you big states think that you have to have in this thing. But then he opened up his ears and he listened. And the big state says, well, now wait just a minute. We've got most of the population. We've got most of the industry. We've got most of the money. Why is it that we shouldn't have a right? And they begin to listen. And a compromise oftentimes is just acknowledging the substance of what your counterpart has to say. You may not agree with it, but at least you can say, I see your point of view. That's extremely important. Now, we have forgotten how to deal with people. We just beat them over the head. And if you don't like it, lump it, you know. Sometimes it's valuable to sit down and see what somebody else has to say. You know, it's amazing that 90% of the time when I can get myself to come to that place, it's not a place I like to be because we like to be right. Amen? We like to be right. We like to be bullies when we're right. But I find when I get myself to that place and I can sit down and I can listen to what that other person has to say from their point of view, I usually can say, you know, I never thought of that. I can see that. I can see your point of view. Sometimes that's what a marriage counselor is all about. You know, what great psychiatric book do you... No, you want to know what the key to successful marriage counseling? Getting both people to shut up long enough to listen to what the other one is saying. And 90% of the time they go, I didn't know you felt that way. I understand that. Well, of course you didn't. You wouldn't shut up long enough to listen. And a compromise couldn't be reached. Sometimes it's just acknowledging the small states finally said, you know, we understand that. I understand how you'd feel as a big state. I understand that this would be a threat to you as a big state. But you've got to understand how I feel as a small state. And the big states begin to listen. And before long, the big states said, okay, I understand what you're saying now. Now then, since we don't want either one of us to win, we have to reach a compromise. And your legislative houses were developed by compromise. One got one thing, the other got the other, and we got the strongest form of government on the face of the earth. Sometimes a compromise is better than either one of the two opinions that were arguing in the first place. Sometimes the compromise is stronger. And the case in point is what we're looking at here with our House of Representatives and our Senate. We had a much better form of government than we would have had if either one of those two sides would have won. So remember that, Christian. Now, there's some things we don't compromise on. We don't compromise on the truth of the Word of God. You see, it's not mine to compromise. This is God's Word. I don't have to argue about whether this is right or wrong with you. That's between you and God. I can't back away from what God has said. I can't cut any slack where God has spoken. But listen, there's a lot of places I can cut some slack. And there's a whole lot of places in life where compromise would be better than either one of the two dissenting opinions. All right, very quickly, let me go and cover one more area. Another compromise. I hope this is not boring you to tears. It ought to be interesting. Another problem that crept up was called the, well, it's actually settled by what's called the Three-Fifths Compromise. And this was between the North and the South. Now, you thought that war wasn't fought till 1865, but I want you to know from the very get-go, there were problems between the North and the South. Yankees have always been hard to live with. Amen. And Southerners have always been bullheaded. And these people still, they had a hard time getting along with one another. And the difference was this. As I said, as the colonies, of course, the original colonies, the first colonies were settled in the North rather than in the South. The Virginia colony at Jamestown struggled for years and years and years and never could get a foothold. And while they were struggling and dying, the Plymouth colony and the Massachusetts colony were settled and they were growing. And so the growth of America literally moved from Massachusetts and Rhode Island and New York and that area. That's where the growth was in America prior to the Revolutionary War. It's where most of the shipping and the trade began. Because of that, the stores that would carry the trade grew there, the trading grew there, everything kind of originated right there in that, what we would call, I guess now, business district. And the North became more business than the South. The South became very agricultural. And it was almost like when you left the South, you left the farm and you went to the big city of the North. And that attitude still pervades today. A lot of Southerners back in the 30s and the 40s and even the 50s, when they grew up, what did they do? They left Kentucky and came north and got a job because they recognized that the jobs, the business, was in the North. And of course, all the business people are working to get their 30 years in, get a little money in retirement so they can do what? Go south, because that's where the farm, the lazy life, the good life, that's where it's at. And so that idea still pervades in society today, but it was prevalent even as the Constitution was being formed. And because of the agriculture ideology of the South, A real problem arose. And that was the problem of slavery. Slavery was a problem even in the Constitution. Slavery was one of those ideas that for the majority of Americans had become distasteful, was recognized as not what America was about, but as I said a while ago, it was one of those necessary evils, particularly for the South. Now, Washington owned slaves, Jefferson owned slaves, most of the men here at this convention owned slaves. And yet, while they seemed to paint themselves as hypocrites, they realized there was a problem with slavery. Even the men that owned them, Jefferson, I'll read you some of the writings of Jefferson, as a matter of fact, we may do that next week, about slavery. And Jefferson, one of the largest slave owners of any of these individuals that were involved in the founding of our country, but Jefferson was opposed to slavery. The problem was, how do you get rid of it without destroying your economy? I'll give you the example. Where are most American goods being made today? Foreign countries. Why? Cheap labor. Now you can talk about the Southerners all you want, and you can indict them on how mean they were. Most of the Southerners had the same ideology that Jefferson had, and that is, this is not good what we're doing. But what else are you going to do? You've talked to manufacturers, Ford and General Motors, and all these guys make these big pretensions, you know, we're making our cars in America. Yeah, but you're making your parts overseas. Do you know if you had a car made exclusively in America, you couldn't buy it? You couldn't afford to buy it. So while we don't like the fact that those people over there will work for 35 cents a day, while we don't like the fact that children over there are working in factories, you can't get away with it without destroying your economy. You see what I'm saying? Now think of that in terms of slavery. What are you going to do to a fellow down here that has got 4,000 acres of land that he tills and plants and raises crops on every year? 4,000 acres. Are you going to tell him you've got to pay all your help 35 cents a day, which back then was a decent wage? You're going to bankrupt him. And so while even the men who framed our Constitution recognized that slavery, something has got to be done, they themselves owned slaves. The question was, how do you get around it? Jefferson's got an interesting plan. I'll read it to you next week from his writings. Jefferson's plan probably would have worked, but it was never implemented. And what happened was he kept pushing the issue back and pushing the issue back and pushing the issue back. And the North took the attitude of, okay, let's get rid of the slaves. Why? Why could they do that? Because they had the industry. They had the industry and they had the ability to produce. The South, on the other hand, said, well, we've got to get more slaves because we've got to raise more crops. And so the South's attitude towards slavery began to change from the North's. And while slaves became less important in the North, they became more important in the South. And rather than deal with the issue, they kept pushing it aside and pushing it aside until in 1860 it just exploded and nearly destroyed the country. The Three-Fifths Compromise. Well, it came to this, that the Southern states, because they had large numbers of slaves, they said, all right, when we're determining who our representatives are, you follow me now? The representatives represented what? The number in the state. So what their ideology was this. When we're picking our representatives, we want to count the slaves as part of the population. But when we're getting taxed, we don't want them to count. Now, the North said, well, what we believe is when you're getting taxed, we ought to count them. But when you're electing representatives, we don't want to count them. So you got two opposing viewpoints again. And so the compromise was reached, called the Three-Fifths Compromise, and that meant that three-fifths of the population of the slaves in the states counted for everything. So actually a slave was really three-fifths of a person, when you think about it. He was a little more than half, but not quite whole, and he counted as three-fifths of a person. And again, you know, again, that was not to slight the slave. You've got to realize these plantation owners are, they're not paying them. But they're housing them, and they're clothing them, and they're feeding them. And in a lot of cases, we hear sometimes the horrendous stories of slavery. I don't defend slavery, don't think slavery was right, but my great-great-grandfather was a slave owner. And matter of fact, there are more people of color with my last name than there are white people. Because after the Civil War, most of the slaves took the surname of the plantation owner. They didn't have one. And from all I know about the goings-on of my grandparents, great-grandparents and whatnot, those people, most of those people that they had owned stayed around and worked on the farm after everything was done. As a matter of fact, what grew out of that was called sharecropping. And sharecropping meant that you farmed, the other fellow owned the land, but you farmed the crop and you gave him a certain percentage of the crop and the rest of it was yours. But you were on his land, you were living on his land, and people all upset with that. My grandfather, I have a lot of grandfathers who were not men of color. They were white, but they were grew up as sharecroppers. My family is a sharecropping family. And the idea of the three-fifths compromise was, how do you handle the slave trade? They weren't saying that's what these people are worth. They were just saying, hey, we're not going to give you credit for all of them because you've got all these numbers that would overwhelm us. And so we're going to give you credit for three-fifths. All right, there's two compromises. Next week, if you remind me, I'll read you what Jefferson had to say about slavery, which was an excellent idea. And we'll continue looking at what this Constitutional Convention compromised and then what they came up with. All right, we'll take a break.